So, yes, as you pointed out, this is my Shabbos HaGadol Drasha. This is the practice run. So what a Shabbos HaGadol Drasha is that it's customary, you know, a rabbi gives a drasha, a sermon, every week. But really, back in the day, there was just two sermons per year. Shabbos Shuvah before Yom Kippur, and Shabbos HaGadol before Pesach. So, and rabbis worked the most on these two sermons. So I've been working on this for months now, even though I've constantly changed and went back and changed what I was going to say and looked, found different things. So this is just where I'm at today on this. But the issues that we're going to discuss are issues that I've been, and many of us have been thinking about for our whole lives, but especially in recent months. So what I want to do is, you know, I've been thinking a lot over the years about what's the best, the proper approach to combating anti-Semitism. And it's something we think about a lot and we debate a lot. And I've had my frustrations with the ways in which our community has decided to address that. And I haven't figured out how to articulate it yet. And so this year I decided I want to just do a deep dive in the commentaries on the Haggadah, on the Passover Haggadah, and see what it teaches me, what comes out of that. And so what I'm going to share with you today is what my deep dive on the Haggadah this year, what it taught me and the approach that I think it's advocating. And it helps me to articulate the approach that I've been kind of feeling for a long time, but now I'm going to try to finally put it into words. So I think a great way to start that is there was a really interesting book written by Hannah Arendt that some of you might have heard of. She was a Holocaust survivor. And she has a great quote that she once said, and in her book she writes, "An anti-Semite claimed that the Jews caused the war. The reply was, yes, the Jews and the bicyclists. Why the bicyclists? Asked the one. Why the Jews? Asked the other." In other words, there's something irrational about anti-Semitism. How do we exactly explain this long-term hatred, which we'll discuss that in a second. But there's one section of the Haggadah that is constantly referred to in this regard. And so let's just take a quick look at that section of the Haggadah, because we're going to come back and analyze it. Towards the beginning of the Passover Haggadah, we say, and I'm not going to sing it, even though in my family we sing this part, and I'm sure many of your families this part is sung, but I don't want you to have this to be too painful of a presentation, so I'm just going to read it to you. So we say, Baruch Shomer Havtachaso L'Yisrael, blessed is the one who kept his promise to the Jewish people, Baruch Hu, Shekadosh Baruch Hu Chishev Esaketz, because God calculated the end of the exile. La'asot k'mo she'amar la'avram avinu, in order to fulfill the promise to Abraham, this is known as the Bris Ben Abasarim, Shenemar v'yomer la'avraham, Yadoa teida ki ger yeh zarecha be'arts lo lehem, you should know that your descendants will be strangers in a land that's not their own. V'avdum v'inu otam arba me'os shana. They will be in servitude and suffer for 400 years. V'gam esagoye sher yavdu dan anochi, and that nation that subjugates them, I will judge. V'achrei chen yitza'u b'rchush gadol. And then they'll leave with much property. That's what we say. That's first we say. Then you lift up the cup, and then you say, and this is especially frequently sung, V'hi she'amda l'avaseinu v'lanu. But here is what has stood for us and our descendants. Shelo echad bilvad amad aleinu l'chaloseinu. That not just one rose up to kill us. By the way, shelo echad. Anyone know shelo? The word shelo, not just one. Anyone know what the gematria, the numerical value of that word is? Shin is 300. Lamed is 30. Aleph is 1. 331. Anyone know how many missiles Iran shot at Israel Saturday night? 331. Pretty interesting, you know? Maybe they checked the Haggadah first before they attacked. So anyways, Shelo echad bilvad amad aleinu l'chaloseinu. Not just one nation has risen up against us to kill us. Ela shebechol dor v'dor omdim aleinu l'chaloseinu. Rather, in every generation, they rise up against us to kill us. V'kadosh baruch hu maaseinu mi'adam. And God saves us from them. Then we put down the cup. And then we say the next paragraph. The question, one of the questions is going to be, are these three paragraphs even related? Many argue that they're not. They might not be. So then after that, we go on and say, now a different part of the Bible, different part of Genesis, right? First, we were talking about Avram. Now we talk about Laban with Yaakov, Yaakov's father-in-law. What did he want to do to Yaakov? Sheparo lo bikesh lo gazer ela ala zecharim. Paro just wanted to kill the boys. V'Lavan bikesh la koras hakol. But Lavan wanted to kill everyone. Shenemar, as it says, Arami oved avi. My father was going to be destroyed by an Aramite. V'yered mitzrayma, and then he went to Egypt. V'yargar sham b'mtemeyat, and he went down there with very little. V'hisham l'goy gadol atzum v'rav, and then left very numerous. So that's the progression in the Haggadah itself. The Haggadah first reminds us that Abraham was promised that his descendants will be slaves, and then they'll be freed. Then we have the statement that in every generation they try to kill us, and then we have this statement about Lavan, that Lavan also was persecuted by his father. I'm sorry, that Yaakov was persecuted by his father-in-law, Lavan. Okay, that's in the Haggadah. Now let's take a step back. And what I want to do with you is let's try to understand the Haggadah and a literary analysis of the text of the Torah. And so for this, I'm going to go to the writings, now on page 2, of Professor Yonatan Grossman, who actually, if you've been coming to this class every week, you've heard me quote a lot. He's a rabbi in the Gush, professor of Tanakh, and does an incredible literary analysis of Tanakh. It just blows me away. So anyways, if you look at Bishalach, if you go to Parshas Bishalach, which is the Parsha when the Jewish people left Egypt, Bishalach, when they left Egypt, there is an interesting structure of that Parsha, of that story. So he writes here that there's a chiastic structure. Chiastic structure is when there's a parallel between like A, B, C, B, A. And you have a parallel between the end, the middle, the beginning, there's constant parallel. So what happens in Bishalach when the Jewish people leave Egypt? First, there's an external enemy. The nation escapes from the Egyptian oppressors, and that's the external enemy, is the Egyptians chasing them. Then they begin to complain, right? It's important in Jewish custom, just joking. They complain about water, right? They arrive in Mara, and they complain that they're thirsty and the bitter waters, and Moshe has to purify the water. They complain. Then they complain about not having enough bread and meat to eat, right? When they arrive in Midbar Sin. And it says that it's a test or something, but anyways, they complain over the bread. Then they complain about water again when they go to Rephidim. And then they have another external enemy, this time Amalek. So he argues that there's a chiastic structure happening where always you look at the middle of the chiastic structure. The middle is that they are complaining about not having enough bread. Okay, just keep that in mind. This was their complaint, even as they were surrounded by enemies, first Egypt, then Amalek. Then something else, another parallel he notices, which is brilliant. When the Jews, before they left Egypt, when they're still in Egypt, they offered a Korban Pesach. They sacrificed a lamb, the Paschal sacrifice, right? They sacrificed before they leave. It was sort of like a sacrifice, but they didn't have an altar. Normally on the altar, they sprinkle blood. So instead of sprinkling blood on the altar, they sprinkled blood on the doorpost. Their homes became the altar. Actually, Professor Grossman argues that's why you can't have chametz in your house, because you can't have chametz on the altar. And so he argues that our homes become the mizbeach. Our homes on Pesach become an altar. Anyways, that happened in Egypt, the sacrifice of the lamb. Then we go into the desert, and then we have something. We complain about bread here. This is the central thing. And then we have miraculous bread. What's it called?
Manna.
The manna. So he points out, he notices, and this is amazing. There's a parallel between the sacrifice of the lamb and the manna. And I have this only in Hebrew, and I apologize, but that's because you have to see the Hebrew parallels. So it says first, it's going back and forth between Shmos, Perek Tazayin, chapter 16 of Exodus, and chapter 12. So first, when it comes to the manna, it says, V'yisuma alehem v'yavo kol adas b'nei Yisrael. The Midbar Sin, they all arrived. The Kol Adat B'nai Yisrael arrived in Midbar Sin. If you go back in chapter 12, when we talked about the Korban Pesach, it said, Dibru El Kol Adat B'nai Yisrael Le'mor B'Esor L'Chodesh, that you should bring the Korban Pesach. Again, the same exact phrase. You can get some pizza. Okay. Dibru, again, Kol Adat B'nai Yisrael. Then the manna, again, it says, Zed Devar Asher Tziva Hashem Li'tu Mimenu, Ish lefi achlo. Take the manna, the amount that you want to take, the amount that you can eat. Ish lefi achlo. The Korban Pesach said the exact same thing. Ish lefi achlo techosu aseh. You eat, that's how much you eat the Karban Pesach. The manna, it said, Vayomer Moshe el Alehem, Ish al Yoser Mimenu ad Boker. You were not allowed to leave it till the morning. You had to finish it all that night. Karban Pesach, it says, Vlosasur Mimenu ad Boker. You have to finish it all that night. I mean, it's the parallels are so striking that it can't not be intentional, right? There's one more on page 3, where it says, when you eat the manna, al yetze ish mimakomo, don't leave your place. And then when it comes to the Korban Pesach, it said, lo teitzeu ish mipesach beso, don't leave your place. So clearly, there's some kind of parallel between bringing the Korban Pesach, the sacrifice that they brought when they were being freed from Egypt, and the manna that they received when miraculously from God when as their food in the desert. What's the connection? So here's his argument. In that same chapter where we learn about the manna that arrived, if you want to learn with us, there's the sheets in the back, and we're on page 3, I'm sorry. When we learn about the manna that we received, that same parak, it says, Vayilonu kol adas b'nei Yisrael, Moshe vel Aaron b'midbar. They complained to Moshe and Aaron in the desert. And then it says, Vayomer aleihem b'nei Yisrael, mi yitein moseinu b'yad Hashem. So the people complained, we would have just died by God's hand, the Eretz Mitzrayim. If God would have just killed us there, why should we have to starve to death? The rabbis say, Chazal, the rabbis say, that starving to death is one of the worst deaths. There's only one death that they say is worse than that, by the way. What?
Captivity.
Captivity. Very good. Yes. It's a reminder that we should be thinking about also the people in captivity. We should be thinking about people who are starving at our Seder. We should be thinking about people who are spending Passover in horrible captivity. Anyways, they were starving, and they said, couldn't we have just died in Egypt? B'yad Hashem, God could have just killed us in Egypt, Be'eretz Mitzrayim. B'shivtenu al sira basar. There, at least we had meat ba'achlenu lechem l'svo, and we had plenty of bread to eat. Wouldn't that have been better? Okay, so what just happened? Again, just to recap. So the Jewish people left Egypt. There was some kind of structure in that chapter in Bishalach that seems to indicate that we're attacked by the Egyptians. Then we're complaining Then we get bread. Then we're complaining. Then we're attacked by the Amalekites. Then we saw that there's a parallel, exact parallel in the psukim, in the words, between the Korban Pesach and the manna that they ate. There's something being hinted at that there's a direct parallel. Something is being taught to us about the connection between manna and Korban Pesach. Then the people say, we wish we'd have just died by God's hand in Egypt. Professor Grossman, who I'm quoting here, if you remember the Noruz, we talked about Noruz. He was the one that had that whole insight about Noruz and Purim. He one of his areas of scholarship is understanding ancient religious practice. Because sometimes you can't understand contemporary issues without understanding the ancient, where were they coming from? What was the context? So he argues that why does it say that they wanted to die by God's hand? And first of all, he points out, he mentions here Aaron. Aaron, who had been absent the last few chapters, all of a sudden he returns here during the instructions for the Korban Pesach. Aaron is back. Aaron a Kohen. So he says, okay, they say they want to die in Egypt, in Egypt, and they want to die by the hand of Hashem. And they're saying it was a place, Egypt was a place of life, right? There we had plenty of food and meat and everything we needed. We had it all there in Egypt. So the people, by the way, are constantly contrasting life in the desert to life in Egypt, both physically and spiritually. So what do we need to know about Egyptian history? You're welcome to take some pizza if you like also. What do we need to know about Egyptian history and their religious practice? What the context that the Jewish people are coming from at this time? So Professor Grossman points out that there seems to be a belief happening here that God has no control over the people in the wilderness. There's no food there. God was only in Egypt. Meaning, why would they say, I wish God would have killed us in Egypt? They could have just said, why doesn't God just kill us now? Because we can't. Why did God need to kill us in Egypt? So here's his argument. This is fascinating. Look at the paragraph. I'm just going to read it here. He says, the nation's complaint, this is page 3 in the middle, must be understood in light of the religious beliefs which pervaded the ancient world. The notion of a deity who reigned supreme in a given setting or against certain nations, but was powerless in other settings or against other nations was quite common, meaning a deity that could only do certain things at certain times or in certain places, but not an all-powerful God. B'nai Yisrael, the Jewish people, may very well have been misled by this theological misconception that one who leaves the city for the desert forgoes the protection of the merciful God. Meaning, they're still learning, right? They're still learning about God. Only to be subject to the demons and spirits which indiscriminately control the uninhabited wilderness. It would seem that this grave error forms the basis of this specific complaint. Meaning, they're still thinking in Egyptian terms. They had to be still trained about what is God. They're about to be revealed. God's about to reveal God's self to them. But they're still thinking like Egyptians who thought that God could only do things in certain places at certain times. So now they're like, well, we're stuck in the desert. How are we going to live out here? We can't even call out to God. What can we do? We could go back to Egypt where there's God. So now they're being taught, though, because this is the chapter where they're being taught about the manna. But the whole goal of manna is about faith, having faith, right? This chapter is the people learning that God does appear and does provide for them in the desert. That's why, and in fact, I think it's worthwhile to read his words inside. He says, however, this basic tenet cannot be sufficiently absorbed into the national mindset through a single incident alone. The educational process demands the constant reinforcement of basic values until they become second nature. That's why the manna came to facilitate this intimate awareness. This heavenly bread descended miraculously each morning, with a double portion appearing on Friday in anticipation of the absence of the manna on Shabbat. Each morning the people experience firsthand the Almighty's providence in the desert. Every morning they wake up hungry, where are we going to eat? And then God provided it for them. And they had no choice but to trust in God. Where else could they get food? They didn't have food. Gradually they realized that God's providence implies in the desert as well, and that became understood. But it took a teaching, how they had to learn this in the desert. And as the manna fell from the sky, the people were shown that God's descent to sanctify his nation extends beyond the borders of Egypt. So this is what's happening with this whole parallel between the Korban Pesach, where they were thanking God, and then they go into the desert where they think they're alone, and God's showing them, look, just like you thanked God in Egypt, you can thank God anywhere. And by the way, God is with you anywhere, not just in Egypt. They even thought, as bad as it was in Egypt, God was with us there, but seems to have abandoned us. So the Torah is trying to say, God never abandons you. God's still with you. So let's go on a little bit further. So actually, you know what? Let's go back to the front page, because I want to show you one more textual analysis, and then we'll go to page 4, because this is where it really gets good, in my opinion. So back on page 1. So now, remember, we read at the outset these three chapters, the three paragraphs, with Vehi Sha'amda in the middle. First, it started with, once again, the Bris Bein HaMitzarim. Hashem promises to Abraham, your descendants will be slaves, and they will suffer, and it will be difficult, but in the end, I'll take them out. I'll be with them. Then the Haggadah says, and this is a very ancient text in the Haggadah, by the way, this goes back to the first Haggadah, the earliest we have, the Rambam, Sajja Gaon's, which the only one difference, by the way, we have in ancient Haggadahs, some say Vehi, some say just He, which the debate is this paragraph connected to the previous paragraph or not? There's a whole debate about that. We're going to talk about that right now. So we had this Vehi Sha'amda, God, it says that in every generation, they're going to attack you and try to kill you, but God will be with you. Then we had the next paragraph, which is it connected, is it not? Which says that Lavan was even worse than Paro to Yaakov. Yaakov suffered from Lavan. Are these three paragraphs connected or not? So Rabbi David Foreman, who does also incredible textual analysis of Tanakh, of the Torah, has a great analysis of these three paragraphs. And he shows, the question is, what is the Vehi referring to? When it said, Vehi Sha'amda, this has stood for us in every generation, that not just one tried to kill us, but everyone tries to kill us, and God protects us. What's the Vehi? What is it saying that this stood for us? It just says, this stands for us. What stands for us? Does it stand for us that the promise to Abraham? What's exactly the Vehi? It's a great, great question even to ask at your Seder. Just say, what does he mean, Vehi? And I'm going to tell you the answer. The answer. No, but a very good answer. And then is there a connection between the Lavan, and also why does it then go and say Lamad? It's a very, rabbinic phrase, like a proof text. It's a very rabbinic phrase. So now if we go back to the first paragraph, look at that paragraph. And it says that in this Bris Bein HaMitzarim, in this time, in this covenant that God made with Abraham, it said you will be slaves for 400 years. Then, Dan Anochi, then I'll judge them and I'll take you out. And then it says, Vehi Sha'amda. So maybe the most the very radical claim that the Vihi Shamda is saying, it's actually a commentary on the first paragraph, and it's making the audacious claim that it's saying, yeah, we'll be slaves, it will be freed, but the promise is much more. The Vihi Shamda is saying, God promised that we're going to be slaves in Egypt, and that we'll be taken out. Vihi Shamda is coming and saying, no. God was not promising just that we're going to be slaves in Egypt and then be out. God was promising a lot more right there. God was promising this is going to happen in every generation, and in every generation, I'm going to be with you. How do we know that's the promise? And by the way, it's saying that that promise is still in effect today. That promise still is in effect for us. And always, right? Not just in Egypt. Because it could have, right, which that, by the way, could have ended Jewish civilization, right? The slavery, that could have been the end of Judaism. But Hashem protected us and took us out. So how do we know? So Rabbi Foreman argues that the next paragraph is the proof text. Tzei Lamad is often a proof. It's giving you a proof. So now it's saying, so the Haggadah is saying, it's going to happen in every generation. And how do you know it's going to happen? Look at what happened. Look at what happens next. Then you have the concept that that Yaakov was in Lavan. But that, you could say, it happens a lot. God protects us. No, Lavan also wanted to destroy us. So how do we know that Lavan and Paro are, there's a parallel? Okay, now I'll turn to page 4. Meaning, is there a parallel between Lavan and Paro? Why is it saying this? So if you go to page 4, on the top there, he points out that in the Psukim that refer to when Yaakov ran away from Lavan. Remember, eventually Yaakov decided, I got to get out of here. And we'll talk about why in a second. When Yaakov says, I'm leaving, I'm fleeing, I'm taking my family, and I'm running. It says there, V'ikach es echav imo v'yirdof acharav derech shivas yamim. Yaakov ran, and Lavan was yirdof acharav. And then Lavan caught up with him. And it says, V'yaseg Lavan es Yaakov. Lavan caught up, and it uses the phrase, V'yaseg Lavan es Yaakov. Now, look in the next verses there, the Exodus from Egypt. When the Jews left Egypt, it says, V'yachazek Hashem eslev paro melech Mitzrayim, v'yirdof acharei b'nei Yisrael yotzim b'yad ramah. V'yirdof, the same exact word that when Lavan chased, Lavan was v'yirdof acharav, and with Paro chasing the Jews, it was v'yirdof acharei. They chased them. And then they caught up with them. And when they caught up with them, same word again. V'yirdofu mitzrim achareihem v'yasigu. And then the same word, v'yasigu. They caught up. They caught up. The exact same language. If you notice that the story with Lavan and the story with Paro, the exact same language is used. In other words, the Exodus was just a replay of Lavan. The Lavan happened first. So the Exodus was just replaying what happened. Right? And by the way, why did Yaakov know it was time to leave when he knew it was time to leave? Rav Soloveitchik points out, if you look at it, I didn't put it on the sheet because I didn't want to have too much here, but Rav Soloveitchik points out that it was right when Yosef was born. When Yosef is born, Yaakov realizes, I have to go now. What's the connection with Yosef being born and it's time to go? What? Okay, there is a whole connection with eventually Yosef. There's a lot there that eventually Yosef got. But what? But before that even, it said before, Dora vi yeshuvahenu. The fourth generation is when God will come back. One place says 400 years. But by the way, were they even slaves for 400 years? How many years? 210. How many years was Yaakov in Lavan's house?
I thought it counts in the binding of Isaac.
Okay, fine. But let's just say the actual servitude, the actual slavery was 210 years. How many years was Yaakov in Lavan's house? Anyone remember?
14.
Plus 7. 21. 21 years. Yaakov realized Yosef is born. How many generations has it been since Avraham? Four, the fourth generation. Yaakov knew that God promised to Avraham, your children will be slaves and they will suffer, and in an Eretz Lo Lehem, in a land that's not theirs, and I will take them out. Yaakov is suffering. He's in servitude. He's in a land not his own. He realizes it's the fourth generation. That promise must have been to me. So he goes. Was the promise to him? Well, we say the promise was referring to slavery in Egypt, but maybe what we're learning now is, yes, the promise was to him and to Egypt. And to who else? Every generation. Bechol dor v'dor. That's what it's saying. That's Bechol dor v'dor. In other words, the Torah is confirming Yaakov's thought and saying it happens in every generation, but Hashem protects us in every generation. Lavaseinu velanu. That so Rabbi Foreman argues that the Haggadah, what it's doing there is it was saying, God promised to Abraham, you're going to be slaves, but I'll take you out. Then the Haggadah says, but actually, God will do this for us in every generation. How do I know? Because he did this for Lavan in a way that is a direct parallel for the slaves in Egypt. And that's how it's teaching us that it will happen in every generation. It's showing you two examples as a way of saying it's not just those two. So let's go to contemporary times. Turn to back. If you go on page 4, Rabbi Jonathan Sacks writes in one of his great books, Future Tense. He has a chapter there about anti-Semitism, which, by the way, he doesn't have a lot of writings about anti-Semitism. Why? Well, he wrote this in 2009, and he writes in that book, and I can relate to this. I know what he's talking about. He says, I never experienced anti-Semitism as a child. He talks about how his father, you know, they were Holocaust survivors, and they lived with it. Consciousness of anti-Semitism. In fact, he jokes like, we would sit at a red light, and if it didn't turn green, my father would say, oh, anti-Semitic lights, you know, because everything's like anti-Semitism. But Rabbi Sacks says, you know, I didn't experience anti-Semitism growing up. So he says, I never experienced it as a child. When we came to the passage in the Haggadah that says, it was not one Paro alone who stood against us to destroy us, but in every generation they stand against us and try to destroy us, I felt very detached. I felt a wry detachment. That was then, not now. My parents' world, not mine. Yet despite that, the hate has returned. Never again had become ever again. Meaning Rabbi Sacks is pointing out that in the 80s and 90s, he wasn't really experiencing it, but then a sudden started to come in back very strongly in the 2010s. And he's like, oh, it's real. I'm really experiencing it. I'm really seeing that it's back. And he's saying, now I realize the Haggadah, which I thought, it's not every generation. It was my parents' generation, and now it's my generation again. It's back. So he argues, and I think this is really interesting. We're going to maybe critique it, but I think it's fascinating. How do you contextualize it? So he says, the best way to understand anti-Semitism is to see it as a virus. Viruses attack the human body, but the body itself has an immensely sophisticated defense, the human immune system. How then do viruses survive and flourish? By mutating. Anti-Semitism mutates, and in so doing, defeats the immune system set up by cultures to protect themselves against hatred. So that's his argument, is that anti-Semitism should be seen as a mutating virus. He argues that basically anti-Semitism is not just a doctrine or a set of beliefs, it's actually a set of contradictions. For example, the Pew study, if you saw the recent Pew study, it said when people had to choose, who is your most respected minority group? And they said Jews are the most respected minority group in America. They also looked at FBI crime statistics. Which religious group experiences the most religious-based violent hate crimes? Jews. It's like, you're the most respected and the most hated. Jews, he argues, Jews are hated for being rich. Jews are hated for being too poor. Jews are hated for being capitalist. Jews are hated for being communist. Jews are hated because they kept to themselves. Jews are hated because they infiltrate everywhere. Jews are hated because they keep their own religion. They're accused of being part of other religions. Jews are hated because they started the pandemic. The Jews are hated because they don't care about the pandemic. Jews are hated because they're not white enough, right? Like in Nazi Germany. Jews are hated because they're too white, right? It's like, it's a series of contradictions. It's the longest lasting hatred that's mutated throughout all of history. And this year, I read an amazing book that really was helping me prepare for it. I was reading already. I was in a book club that this 1840 podcast that Professor Malka Simkovich was leading. Actually, she's going to be our speaker here on Yom HaShoah, May 5th or 6th, I don't remember. So it's going to be highly recommended. So there was this book club about anti-Semitism. So I was reading these books. And since then, I heard Dara Horn and Barry Weiss and others mentioning this book. I have it here. It's called Anti-Judaism by David Nirenberg. It's a really incredible scholarly work. And it is about basically the entire history of anti-Semitism, going back, obviously, thousands of years. And basically, his thesis, which is a really unique thesis, but he proves it. I mean, it's incredibly scholarly. He's a professor at the University of Chicago. And I actually emailed, corresponded with him, and I'll share that with you in a second. His thesis in this book is that anti-Semitism works differently than racism. It's a different thing. He argues that basically that it's the symbolism of the Jew to represent the worst things in any given civilization. In other words, the Jew represents whatever any given society regards as the most loathsome. That's been the Jews throughout history. And some people think, first of all, we know in the Torah, anti-Semitism goes back to, Paro, or it goes to, Purim story. But some people argue that, no, it starts with Christianity. He argues it's before that. He has a whole chapter on Egyptian mythology in ancient papyrus, not going back to Egypt of the slavery, Egypt of like 300 BC, in that era. And there are actually writings about corruption and tyranny in their society. And they refer to corruption as tyranny as being Jewish, caused by the Jews. Even at times when there was no Jews there. That corruption, the way they say these are Jewish ills on society is whenever there's corruption and tyranny. Even, in ancient Christianity, Judaism was considered the legalistic, the murderous, murderous, legalistic, the non-spiritual aspect. Like, that's how you contrast the spiritual, early Islam. Do you know that early Islam, he points out here, that they often contrasted themselves with the Jews. Do you know the Qibla? You know what the Qibla is? The direction that Muslims face. Just like we face Jerusalem, they face Mecca. It's a different direction. Why do they face Mecca and not Jerusalem? He points out here, early Muslim scholars say, since the Jews faced Jerusalem, we need to show that we're different than the Jews. And in other words, much history, it's not saying anything bad about Muslim, I'm not trying to say anything bad about, negative about any of these religions, but they had to differentiate themselves and say, we need to be different than the Jews. We have to face a different way. In fact, during the Crusades and the blood libels and the Spanish expulsions, he has this whole chapter about how even the Jews, when they converted to Catholicism, weren't really accepted. So much so that, what would you say is the main difference between a Catholic church and a synagogue? If you walked into a Catholic church, what would you see differently than in a church than a synagogue? Okay, besides for the crucifix, but in addition. Symbols, icons, statues, like symbol. Synagogues are supposed to be very plain. So he has this whole, shows this whole history of how some Jewish conversos wrote pamphlets about how important it is to have the churches be plain with no symbolism. And they quoted early church fathers that a church should be plain with no symbols whatsoever. And some of the Catholics at that time felt, maybe you're not really Catholic enough and maybe this is your Judaism coming through. So they instituted that people had to have symbols in their churches and in their homes to show that they're not, that was how they would show that they're not Jewish. In other words, my point is nothing, I'm not saying anything bad, I'm not trying to say anything bad about anyone. I'm just saying there was so often through human history, the way we practice our religion is when we show how we're not Jewish. They wanted to show that we're, and it mutated from Judaism as a religion to Judaism as a race, right? So this was, when as religion lost its authority, science increased in its authority, so race became problematic. So social Darwinism, survival of the fittest, that was very important to Hitler, and eventually that mutated into anti-Zionism and, Amos Oz's famous quote that in the 1930s they would carry banners in Europe that said, Jews, go back to Palestine. And then now today they say, Jews, go back to Europe or Jews, get out of Palestine. And his famous quote was, they don't want us to be there. They don't want us to be here. They just don't want us to be. And the truth is, even the word anti-Semitism, which was coined as a way of saying, you Jews, you're not really white, you're Semites. And then today, people will say, I refuse to use the word anti-Semitism because you're not the real Semites, we're the real Semites. It's like this whole contradiction about what does it mean to be Jewish and this whole irony that it's always using the highest values of any society to show that Jews represent what we're not, and we're going to use them to undermine, to try to explain what's most loathsome, that is the Jews. In fact, the irony of it that Rabbi Sacks points out is that the human rights movement became a movement in a reaction to the Holocaust, right? The Human Rights Commission of the United Nations in 1948, the Nuremberg Laws in 1947, so much of this was in reaction to the Holocaust that genocide and human rights was something that the Jews put on the map, and then the immune system became so sophisticated that now it's the Jews who are guilty of all the, are being accused of all these things. So much so that basically Rabbi Sacks argues the saying goes like this: anti-Semitism is evil. The Holocaust was the worst crime against humanity. Any civilized human must be against it in all matters, no matter who the victim is. Israel treats Palestinians the way Nazis treated Jews. Therefore, Israel's practice of genocide. Therefore, if you oppose anti-Semitism, which you must also oppose Israel. So it's found a way to make it like you have to also oppose, and then if Jews support Israel, you have to oppose the Jews. So this has been like the history of anti-Semitism. This is the Bechol Dor in every generation. The question is, though, what do you do about that? How do you fight it? Is there a vaccine for this virus? Or does it always just, you know, mutate to avoid the vaccine? So I emailed this professor at David Nierenberg. And I asked him what he thinks about Rabbi Sachs's mutating virus theory. Because when I read this book, I felt like, yeah, Nierenberg just proved Rabbi Sachs's theory. Because he gives us so much detail that Rabbi Sachs doesn't give all that detail. I mean, I just mentioned to you a couple points that he makes, but it's a whole book. So I thought, oh, wow, you just proved Rabbi Sachs's theory that anti-Semitism is a mutating virus. So here's what he wrote back to me. I actually put it on the page. He made it the source sheet because it was that good of an email. I mean, this is just part of it. So here's what he wrote to me. The virus metaphor is helpful if it helps us to understand that anti-Semitism is always evolving with historical change and is not some eternal and unchanging thing. That part's true. But it is perhaps harmful, here's where he's disagreeing with Rabbi Sachs, if it suggests that anti-Semitism is some alien and toxic body clearly separable from ourselves and our ideals. It is certainly toxic, but the problem with anti-Semitism, as I try to show in my book, is that it has worked itself so extensively into our cultures and our ideals. It isn't alien to them, right? A virus is separate. He's arguing anti-Semitism is not separate. In that sense, it is more like our own DNA, which, as geneticists have increasingly realized, consists of many regions of often dormant DNA incorporated from parasitic viruses along our evolutionary chain, and which under certain conditions, such as cancers, begins to be expressed. In other words, the self-other distinction between virus and human DNA is not sharp or clear, and neither is the distinction between antisemitism and many human ideals, including idealism itself, as I tried to show in the chapter on German philosophy. So in other words, he's trying to argue that he agrees with Rabbi Sachs, but Rabbi Sachs is arguing that antisemitism is like separate from humanity and it infects them. And he feels that it's intrinsic to humanity. Not, we would never say, God forbid, every human being is an anti-Semite. Never. But that antisemitism is always there in humanity. It's always there in human history. It will always show its head, especially in certain conditions, that there will be some people and some societies that will express itself in terms of antisemitism. In fact, I think after I read Nierenberg, I think that I realized the Vilna Gaon says something like this many years earlier. Look at the Vilna Gaon's commentary on that on page 5 on that statement of Tseu Lamad. Go and learn that we from Love on Treatment of Yaakov. So the Vilna Gaon writes there, Tseu Lamad Milavan Arami Kolomar, which means Shebahashkafa Rishona. At first, it seemed Lo Nira Haraos Asher Asa Love on Yaakov. You can't realize that he's enslaving them. That he's persecuting him. It was very gradual. You don't perceive it. It seems like everything's fine. The Eino Yudua Lanu Ma Bikish Lavan Harami Lasos Yaakov, and you didn't really know what he was trying to do to Yaakov, to the Jewish people. Vafa Pikain Heid Alav Akasu, but the Torah tells us Arami Oved Avi that his goal actually was to destroy us. El Korchach. Who bikesh la'akor esakol. The truth is, he was trying to destroy everything. V'kadosh baruch hu heifech letova, and God turned it to good. Kein hu ose tamid nisim imanu af she'ein anu margishim. That's what God does in every generation. In other words, Lavan, the proof from Lavan was that it was like kind of hidden. You didn't recognize it there. But when there was conflict between Yaakov and Lavan, it came out. And that's what that's like the DNA metaphor of anti-Semitism, that it's more like DNA than it is like a virus that's external. It came out. I think that the Vilna Gaon is agreeing with Professor Nierenberg. In fact, maybe we should say it the other way around. Nierenberg's agreeing with the Vilna Gaon. Yes?
Did Professor Nierenberg or Rabbi Sachs explain why is this in here, part of DNA?
But yeah.
You mentioned that it's different.
Yes, they both explain why. They both give the answer why.
What's the answer?
They have absolutely no idea. It's totally irrational. That's what they both say. So let's go now. So the question is, though, what I'm trying to build up to, and I'm going to try to hit it home now, is so then what do we do about it? We don't know why it comes. What can we do? Yes?
Well, it seems like from the very beginning, God put this into formulation, right?
Yeah.
Like, I'm letting you know this is going to happen.
This is going to happen. It's no matter what.
Yeah, and so it's like something that like seems to be part of destiny, but I do think that like if there's anything that we can learn from the whole Egypt story, and it's like to change our own mindset to further believe in God.
Okay.
Strengthens us and provides us with protection against whatever.
Excellent. So let's come back to that. Good. So, I mean, you pointed out, Rebecca, that it's about strengthening our minds, changing our mindset, focusing our emunah bitachon, our belief in God. So the truth is, I think part of the message, before actually we get into the strategies, which I am going to mention some strategies that I've been really struggling with for a long time. One message you see from this, and just look at everything we've just gone through right now in these sources, it seems to be that just like the hatred returns, so too we can now prove through human history. I mean, this book, Nuremberg's book, for example, or any other history book, proves that what the Haggadah was saying, what the Torah was saying for thousands of years ago, that we're going to be persecuted in every generation, it has come true, right? That prophecy has come true. So if we now see that the prophecy that we're going to be persecuted in every generation comes true, we also see the prophecy that Hashem will protect us comes true, right? So the rabbis were right at the first part, so clearly the second part is also right. In fact, I just put, for example, the famous Mark Twain quote in Harper's Magazine in 1898 concerning the Jews, where he said that, you know, the Jews, the incredible survival of the Jews, they've made a marvelous fight in this world in all the ages and has done it with his hands tied behind him. He could be vain of himself and be excused for it. The Egyptian, the Babylonian, the Persian rose, filled the planet with sound and splendor, then faded it off to dream stuff and passed away. The Greek and the Roman followed and made a vast noise, and they're gone. Other peoples have sprung up and held their torch high for a time, but it burned out, and they sit in twilight now, or have vanished. The Jew saw them all, beat them all, and is now what he always was, exhibiting no decadence, no infirmities of age, no weakening of his parts, no slowing of his energies, no dulling of his alert and aggressive mind. All things are mortal but the Jew. All other forces pass, but he remains. What is the secret of his immortality? And the Aruch HaShulchan, a halachic, legal, Jewish legal text, wrote about this also 100 years ago, and he concludes, "V'ein lecha osu mofes galdum yizeh." There's no bigger sign or miracle than mikiyumenu zman aruch kazeh, than our survival for all these years. Because God is protecting us. Lo sar v'lo yasur. It has never left us. Af rega, even one second. Ka'av mashgiach abano, like a parent looking for their child, for their only child, yechido, miyasur letovaso, and trying to only do things for their good. In other words, we are the ever-dying people, but we stay alive because of God's promise. So what should we be doing about it? Because honestly, you know, as a rabbi in the community, I watch the things that people in our community try to do to fight anti-Semitism, and oftentimes, I must say, I'm frustrated by it. The truth is, if you turn the page, the Sefer Shnayim Yehudeya, I thought this just beautifully points out here, that this whole thing is, it's even if, he says, Ilule Zeba Shavuot, it's a promise from God. We would have thought that the promise wouldn't exist if we sinned. But he says, no, since it's a promise, it will always exist. So now, how do we fight anti-Semitism? What are the strategies? The truth is, there's been a lot in our community. Some of them have been education. We should be education. One of the things I learned from Professor Simkovich, for example, was that Josephus's book, History of the Jews, that was intended, the goal of that book was intended to educate people to try to prevent, you know, to reduce Roman anti-Semitism. But, you know, people didn't listen to the education. You know, when Trump was president, there was a presidential plan. Give Jews Title VI minority protection. That was the big plan. And funding, you know, defund universities that don't, you know, take action, fight BDS. Biden, President Biden recently came out with a plan that also, you know, focused on protecting houses of worship and awareness campaigns and funding the Holocaust museums and summits and online resources. Prager and Telushkin in their book, Why the Jews, argue that people hate Jewish values and something is something about our values that they hate. And therefore, you know, because their argument is Ba Sinai, when Har Sinai happened, Ba Sina. The Gemara says that's when hatred came, something that Torah that they hate. And they argue that, what? Or that it's like it's demanding of them, and they don't want those demands made of them. And either way, they argue that we should be teaching the world Jewish values, and that's the only way to prevent it. That's their argument. Jewish hospitals. Jewish hospitals there was a whole, you know, you see in the bylaws of Jewish hospitals, and I did research on this when I wrote my book, in the minutes from board meetings, they often wrote that the goal of the Jewish hospital was to show that, don't hate us. We're nice. We care for the sick. We welcome everyone in our hospitals. If we're very nice, they won't hate us anymore.
I always thought of being Jewish as being a scapegoat, so that humans need scapegoats because they don't want to take responsibility for
Right.
They're bad stuff.
Okay, that could be one. But there's anti-Semitism in societies where there's no Jews, even. The people never met a Jew hate Jews.
No, but I meant the scapegoat principle.
Uh-huh.
And if God created man needs that, but Judaism teaches us to be responsible.
Uh-huh.
It teaches us, you know, every year we have to forgive.
Right,
but,
okay.
But other people, they're just pissed off.
Right.
They need to find someone to blame.
Right, I hear. But let's go to the solutions. We're out of time. We're already over time, and I still haven't even gotten to the solutions yet. But the problem is, and so others said, you know, after Jewish hospitals, the initial strategy was, just be kind to them, kill them with kindness, and then they'll love us. And today, and then it became like fight. You know, all the different organizations, I'm not going to mention them, but, you know, fight it, and we have to fight back, and we have to fight them. But my question is, if it's DNA, none of that will work. I mean, the only way you could fight DNA, really, I guess, is, what, CRISPR. But, and I've already argued that that's messianic. So in the messianic times, we'll CRISPRify, you know, we'll remove from the DNA, that will be. So no, really, in the times of Mashiach, there won't be, I don't think there will be hatred anymore. No one hating, because we'll have, so CRISPR, you know, if we can get that, you know, as soon as we can get that going, we can get rid of anti-Semitism, we can get the Mashiach. But, here's the three, my three suggestions. That based on this, number one, first of all, we do have to respond. Obviously, I'm not saying we don't respond, but we cannot internalize it. That's the biggest challenge. People are saying lots of bad things about Jews. And the biggest challenge is to be proud to be Jewish. Of course, if Israel or Jews do bad things, we're allowed to admit mistakes. We're allowed to say that things are bad and we regret that things happened, but not to internalize it. There's a beautiful insight on the Haggadah. This is from Rabbi Rosner's Shalom Rav Haggadah. It says that Vayareu otano mitzrim. They did bad to us. That's what it says in the Haggadah. The Egyptians did bad to us. Vayareu. They did bad to us. But he says, the Egyptians were evil to us. But he argues, Rav Avram Shor says in Alekach Valibuv, there's a deeper explanation. Vayareu refers to the Egyptians making us feel bad about ourselves. They made us lose our feelings of self-worth. And then he quotes Rabbi Emanuel Bernstein in the Darkness to Destiny Haggadah, where he says in the name of the Beis HaLevi in Parsha Shmos, that the Haggadah does not interpret Vayareu otano mitzrim to mean the Egyptians were evil to us. Rather, he says it means the Egyptians made us out to be evil. The Beis HaLevi argues that our enemies seek to portray us as evil in every generation. That's the goal, to make us look like we're the bad guys. Because how do you wipe out a nation? It's not politically correct to order extermination of human beings. It just doesn't work. Yet if I'm able to create a sense that they're not really human beings, that they're really coming from the devil, that they're really a leech on society, then yes, I could kill leeches. Our enemies throughout history have tried to dehumanize us to say that we do not have the right to live. So, and the truth is, as Rabbi Sachs argues, a lot of it all makes sense in its own societies. Blood libels only make sense to people who believe in transubstantiation, right? Conspiracy theories made a lot of sense in Tsarist Russia. So in every society you're in, if you're talking, you know, so that's one. Number two, unity. Unity, first of all, alliance with many good, great non-Jews out there who are loving and kind to Jews and who saved Jews during the Holocaust and would save Jews today. To have alliances and also to emphasize Jewish unity. Remember what happened the week before October 7th. And I'm not saying why God does things, but we know that we were at our most disunified time in Jewish history. Literally, Yom Kippur prayers were being protested against in Tel Aviv, by Jews. It was a very disunified time. And look what the Sfas Emma says on this. When it said, Shelo echad bilvad amar aleinu, not just one nation went up against us to destroy us, but many. The Sfas Emma says, no, it means something deeper. Shelo echad, look what it says in the middle of the page. Hainu, she'en Yisrael mu'chadin. It's when we're not unified. Bilvad, just that. Davarzeh bilvad gorm she'yamod she'yomdim aleinu l'chaoseinu. When we're not unified, then they attack us. Then they know that we can be destroyed. When we have lack of unity. When we're unified, when we're kind to each other, when we're respectful, then no one can attack, no one can hurt us. No one can overcome that unity. But when we're not unified, it happens. And then the most controversial thing that I want to say, but I think it's right, but I mean, just saying I think it's controversial is to some people, because there are some Jews who love to fight anti-Semitism, and it makes me cringe. Like, let's just look at an example, Kyrie Irving. When Kyrie Irving, the basketball player who, I don't know, posted something on his Twitter that like some, you know, anti-Semitic movie or something. And then he had to sit out from playing basketball until he apologized to the Jews. And everyone was protesting at the games. He shouldn't be allowed to play until he apologizes to the Jews. And do you remember what people were tweeted after that? There was this quote, "To learn who rules over you, find out who you can't criticize." It was just a little bit like cringy, like, we need him to apologize to us? Like, sometimes, and there's certain people out there who they just love to fight. Let me find an anti-Semite and let me make their life miserable. And let me show them how they're going to suffer for hating us. Is that going to make them not hate us anymore? Is that going to protect us by fighting them? But what do we have to do? The main thing, and this is from the Sefer Maaseh Hashem. This is a great Sefer. I heard Rav Hershel Schechter once quote it and say that it's a great but not utilized enough Sefer. So I started reading it. He was the grandson of the Maharik, 15th century Egypt, Greece, and then Poland. He says in here that if you look at what the word said, it said, V'hakadosh Baruch Hu matzilenu mi'adam. What did Hashem do? Was Hashem's goal to kill the Egyptians? Matzilenu mi'adam. He protected us. The main thing is defense, protecting. He said, V'hakadosh Baruch Hu matzilenu mi'adam ve'enu horgam. But not to kill them. He tilasenu shebezeh is parsem ha'avaso ha'atzuma aleinu. God shows God's love for us by protecting us. Like what happened this weekend when all those missiles didn't get through and didn't kill anyone. Right? It's protecting us. The goal is not how many anti-Semites we can kill. The goal is to protect us. Even at the Seder, yes, some Egyptians had to be killed when they were chasing the Jews. But we drop out, we pour out wine. We say we don't want to celebrate their deaths. He does point out further on, he says, sometimes it has to be. He says, sometimes there's no choice. Sometimes defense, is killing stuff. Sometimes someone's chasing you and you have no choice. You can't save your life other than killing them. So you have to. But the goal is defensive, protecting yourself. So if number one, we said that the fighting anti-Semitism is be proud, don't internalize it. Don't believe the things they're saying about us. Number two, the Sas Emes, maintain unity. Shelo Achad, not having Achdus. Number three, though, the most important is not necessarily being aggressive and offensive. I'm not saying we have to just say, you know what, let it go. If people are talking about it, just let it go. Just ignore it. No, we have to protect ourselves. We have to protect people. You have to be realistic. One thing we learned in Jewish history, when someone says they're coming to kill you, believe it. Be smart. If someone does something illegal, they have to get persecuted for it. I'm not saying to not, but the overly aggressive fighting of anti-Semitism, I think, is counterproductive. I want to go back to the Jewish hospital model of, you know what, just be good and kind. And that's the best thing we can do. Sometimes you could say, some people have said about Israel, why do they care about protecting civilians when they're just going to be blamed for killing civilian Gazans anyways? So why should we be so careful? Because Israel is being extremely careful, extremely careful about civilian life. And they're still being blamed for killing civilians. So some people say, so why should they care? No, we can't say that. We have to say, why should we care? Because this is the right thing to do. And yes, they're still going to say, they're still going to lie about us. But we still have to do the right thing. We just do the right thing. The Chofetz Chaim was once asked, how do you fight anti-Semitism? I apologize, we're going to wrap up in just a second. I'm wrapping up right now, I promise. I know I went over. At my synagogue, we would now be in Saturday night. People would be like, no, Rabbi, you got to go. Anyways, the Chofetz Chaim quoted the Gemara in Sanhedrin, Sadi Ches. And he said, how do you fight anti-Semitism? The Gemara says, Ma yasa adam linatzel michevli Mashiach. How can you be prevented from the suffering from birth pains of Mashiach? Yasok betorah ubegimilus chasadim. Learn Torah and do chesed. Be kind to people. That's it. That's what we can do. We can just simply do the right thing. Do the right thing because it's the right thing, even if it won't change anyone. And finally, the Jews, when they were running from Paro, they probably thought, that's it. We're done. We're running from a huge army. We're not an army. And we have an army chasing us. We're running to a sea. And we're going to die there. That's it. We're dead. And who would have predicted the sea would open up? They'll run through the sea, and then it will close on the enemies, and they'll be fine. They couldn't have predicted that, but they just ran and bitchu b'Hashem adayad. They trusted in God. They had trust. They do tshuva, tefillah, tzedakah, and at the end of the day, Tzur Yisrael, kuma be'ez Yisrael. At the end of the day, we trust that Hashem will protect us. Hashem has protected us and been with us for all of our history, and He will continue to be with us. All we have to do is have faith, do the right thing, be good people, be kind people, and protect ourselves and. The Haggadah is promising it will be okay. It is going to turn out okay because God is with us. Chag Kasher v'Sameach. I'm wishing everyone, I hope it makes sense. I'm open to your critique and challenges, but.
You can't.
Yeah, exactly. It's irrational. That's the point. It's irrational, so what can you do?
You have to see
God's. But the main point is that's why I took you on that whole journey of the Jewish people from Egypt through the desert and the comparison between the Korban Pesach and the manna, that where the people gradually developed their reliance on God and their faith in Hashem and their emunah. And so too, as they were surrounded first by the Egyptians, then by the Amalekites, and they learned how to have faith in God in difficult times and in all places and all times, so too we learn, have to learn and teach ourselves to have faith in God today. Even when we think that there's other methods and strategies, we have to rely on HaKadosh Baruch Hu, rely on God. And as we say, Kimei Tzeitzcha Mi'eretz Mitzrayim, Erenu Niflos.